Chapter 3, Part 1 of Emily Climbs by Lucy Maud Montgomery. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 3, In the Watches of the Night, Part 1. Some of us can recall the exact time in which we reached certain milestones on life's road, the wonderful hour when we passed from childhood to girlhood, the enchanted, beautiful, or perhaps the shattering and horrible, hour when girlhood was suddenly womanhood, the chilling hour when we faced the fact that youth was definitely behind us, the peaceful, sorrowful hour of the realization of age. Emily Starr never forgot the night when she passed the first milestone and left childhood behind her forever. Every experience enriches life, and the deeper such an experience, the greater the richness it brings. That night of horror and mystery and strange delight ripened her mind and heart like the passage of years. It was a night early in July. The day had been one of intense heat. Aunt Elizabeth had suffered so much from it that she had decided she would not go to prayer meeting. Aunt Laura and Cousin Jimmy and Emily went. Before leaving, Emily asked and obtained Aunt Elizabeth's permission to go home with Ilsa Burnley after meeting, to spend the night. This was a rare treat. Aunt Elizabeth did not at all approve of all-night absences as a general thing. But Dr. Burnley had to be away, and his housekeeper was temporarily laid up with a broken ankle. Ilsa had asked Emily to come over for the night, and Emily was to be permitted to go. Ilsa did not know this, hardly hoped for it, in fact, but was to be informed at prayer meeting. If Ilsa had not been late, Emily would have told her before meeting went in, and the mischances of the night would probably have been averted. But Ilsa, as usual, was late, and everything else followed in course. Emily sat in the Murray pew near the top of the church by the window that looked out into the grove of fir and maple that surrounded the little white church. This prayer meeting was not the ordinary weekly sprinkling of a faithful few. It was a special meeting, held in view of the approaching Communion Sunday, and the speaker was not young, earnest Mr. Johnson, to whom Emily always liked to listen, in spite of her blunder at the Ladies' Aid supper, but an itinerant evangelist lent by Shrewsbury for one night. His fame brought out a church full of people, but most of the audience declared afterwards they would much rather have heard their own Mr. Johnson. Emily looked at him with her level, critical gaze, and decided that he was oily and unspiritual. She heard him through a prayer and thought, "Giving God good advice and abusing the devil isn't praying." She listened to his discourse for a few minutes and made up her mind that he was blatant and illogical and sensational, and then proceeded, coolly, to shut mind and ears to him and disappear into dreamland, something which she could generally do at will when anxious to escape from discordant realities. Outside, moonlight was still sifting in a rain of silver through the firs and maples, though an ominous bank of cloud was making up in the northwest, and repeated rumblings of thunder came on the silent air of the hot summer night, a windless night for the most part, though occasionally a sudden breath that seemed more like a sigh than a breeze brushed through the trees and set their shadows dancing in weird companies. There was something strange about the night in its mingling of placid, accustomed beauty with the omens of rising storm that intrigued Emily, and she spent half the time of the evangelist's address in composing a mental description of it for her Jimmy book. The rest of the time she studied such of the audience as were within her range of vision. This was something Emily never wearied of in public assemblages, and the older she grew, the more she liked it. It was fascinating to study those varied faces, and speculate on the histories written in mysterious hieroglyphics over them. They had all their inner secret lives, those men and women, known to no one but themselves and God. Others could only guess at them, and Emily loved this game of guessing. At times it seemed veritably to her that it was more than guessing, that in some intense moments she could pass into their souls and read therein hidden motives and passions, that were, perhaps, a mystery even to their possessors. It was never easy for Emily to resist the temptation to do this when the power came, although she never yielded to it without an uneasy feeling that she was committing trespass. It was quite a different thing from soaring on the wings of fancy into an ideal world of creation, quite different from the exquisite, unearthly beauty of the Flash. Neither of these gave her any moments of pause or doubt. But to slip on tiptoe through some momentarily unlatched door, as it were, and catch a glimpse of masked, unuttered, unutterable things in the hearts and souls of others, was something that always brought, along with its sense of power, a sense of the forbidden, a sense even of sacrilege. Yet Emily did not know if she would ever be able to resist the allure of it. She had always peered through the door and seen the things before she realized that she was doing it. They were nearly always terrible things. Secrets are generally terrible. Beauty is not often hidden, only ugliness and deformity. "Elder Forsyth would have been a persecutor in old times," she thought. "He has the face of one. This very minute he is loving the preacher because he is describing hell, and Elder Forsyth thinks all his enemies will go there. Yes, that is why he is looking pleased. I think Mrs. Bowes flies off on a broomstick o' nights. She looks it. 400 years ago she would have been a witch, and Elder Forsyth would have burned her at the stake. She hates everybody. It must be terrible to hate everybody, to have your soul full of hatred. I must try to describe such a person in my Jimmy book. I wonder if hate has driven all love out of her soul, or if there is a little bit left in it for anyone or anything. If there is, it might save her. That would be a good idea for a story. I must jot it down before I go to bed. I'll borrow a bit of paper from Ilsa. No, here's a bit in my hymn book. I'll write it now. I wonder what all these people would say if they were suddenly asked what they wanted most, and had to answer truthfully. I wonder how many of these husbands and wives would like a change. Chris Farrar and Mrs. Chris would. Everybody knows that. I can't think why I feel so sure that James Beatty and his wife would, too. They seem to be quite contented with each other. But once I saw her look at him when she did not know anyone was watching, oh, it seemed to me that I saw right into her soul, through her eyes, and she hated him and feared him. She is sitting there now beside him, little and thin and dowdy, and her face is gray and her hair is faded, but she herself is one red flame of rebellion. What she wants most is to be free from him, or just to strike back once. That would satisfy her. There's Dean. I wonder what brought him to prayer meeting. His face is very solemn, but his eyes are mocking Mr. Sampson. What's that Mr. Sampson saying? Oh, something about the wise virgins. I hate the wise virgins. I think they were horribly selfish. They might have given the poor foolish ones a little oil. I don't believe Jesus meant to praise them any more than he meant to praise the unjust steward. I think he was just trying to warn foolish people that they must not be careless and foolish, because if they were, prudent, selfish folks would never help them out. I wonder if it's very wicked to feel that I'd rather be outside with the foolish ones trying to help and comfort them than inside feasting with the wise ones. It would be more interesting, too. There is Mrs. Kent and Teddy. Oh, she wants something terribly. I don't know what it is, but it's something she can never get, and the hunger for it goads her night and day. That is why she holds Teddy so closely, I know. But I don't know what it is that makes her so different from other women. I can never get a peep into her soul. She shuts everyone out. The door is never unlatched. What do I want most? It is to climb the alpine path to the very top, and write upon its shining scroll a woman's humble name. We're all hungry. We all want some bread of life, but Mr. Sampson can't give it to us. I wonder what he wants most. His soul is so muggy I can't see into it. He has a lot of sordid wants. He doesn't want anything enough to dominate him. Mr. Johnson wants to help people and preach truth. He really does. And Aunt Janey wants most of all to see the whole heathen world Christianized. Her soul hasn't any dark wishes in it. I know what Mr. Carpenter wants, his one lost chance again. Catherine Morris wants her youth back. She hates us younger girls because we are young. Old Malcolm Strang just wants to live, just one more year, always just one more year, just to live, just not to die. It must be horrible to have nothing to live for except just to escape dying. Yet he believes in heaven. He thinks he will go there. If he could see my flash just once, he wouldn't hate the thought of dying so, poor old man. And Mary Strang wants to die, before something terrible she is afraid of tortures her to death. They say it's cancer.
There's mad Mr. Morrison up in the gallery. We all know what he wants, to find his Annie. Tom Sibley wants the moon, I think, and knows he can never get it. That's why people say he's not all there. Amy Crabb wants Max Terry to come back to her. Nothing else matters to her. I must write all these things down in my Jimmy book tomorrow. They are fascinating. But after all, I think I like writing of beautiful things better. Only these things have a tang beautiful things don't have in some way. Those woods out there, how wonderful they are in their silver and shadow. The moonlight is doing strange things to the tombstones. It makes even the ugly ones beautiful. But it's terribly hot. It is smothering here, and those thunder growls are coming near. I hope Ilsa and I will get home before the storm breaks.
Oh, Mr. Samson, Mr. Samson, God isn't an angry God. You don't know anything about him if you say that. He's sorrowful, I'm sure, when we're foolish and wicked, but he doesn't fly into tantrums. Your God and Ellen Green's God are exactly alike. I'd like to get up and tell you so, but it isn't a Murray tradition to sass back in church. You make God ugly, and he's beautiful. I hate you for making God ugly, you fat little man.
Whereupon Mr. Sampson, who had several times noticed Emily's intent, probing gaze, and thought he was impressing her tremendously with a sense of her unsaved condition, finished with a final urgent whoop of entreaty, and sat down. The audience, in the close, oppressive atmosphere of the crowded, lamp-lit church, gave an audible sigh of relief, and scarcely waited for the hymn and benediction before crowding out to purer air. Emily, caught in the current, and parted from Aunt Laura, was swept out by way of the choir door to the left of the pulpit. It was some time before she could disentangle herself from the throng and hurry around to the front, where she expected to meet Ilsa. Here was another dense, though rapidly thinning, crowd, in which she found no trace of Ilsa. Suddenly Emily noticed that she did not have her hymn-book. Hastily she dashed back to the choir door. She must have left her hymn-book in the pew, and it would never do to leave it there. In it she had placed for safekeeping a slip of paper on which she had furtively jotted down some fragmentary notes during the last hymn, a rather biting description of scrawny Miss Potter in the choir, a couple of satiric sentences regarding Mr. Sampson himself, and a few random fancies which she had desired most of all to hide, because there was in them something of dream and vision which would have made the reading of them by alien eyes a sacrilege. Old Jacob Banks, the sexton, a little blind and more than a little deaf, was turning out the lamps as she went in.
He had reached the two on the wall behind the pulpit. Emily caught her hymn-book from the rack. Her slip of paper was not in it. By the faint gleam of light, as Jacob Banks turned out the last lamp, she saw it on the floor, under the seat of the pew in front. She kneeled down and reached after it. As she did so, Jacob went out and locked the choir door. Emily did not notice his going. The church was still faintly illuminated by the moon that as yet outrode the rapidly climbing thunderheads. That was not the right slip of paper after all. Where could it be? Oh, here at last. She caught it up and ran to the door, which would not open. End of chapter 3, part 1.